So I went the next day, and I talked to the lady in the art gallery, and I said, you know, can I buy this on time? Give you $20 and then pay off the rest in 2 or 3 months. Sure, okay. So I bought the lithograph, and I said, who is this artist? You know, where the guy? I think I would like to know more about him. She said, well, come in the next room. So she came. I went in the next room, and here's this large painting of the lithograph in full color. And I went ape, you know, and I said, oh, my God, isn't that so beautiful? How much is this? Well, $300. Well, that's ridiculous. Then she showed me another painting over in another corner, huge thing, which I now own the original of a medieval, a Renaissance train moving across a trestle with no beginning and no end. The front end's broken off, the back half's broken off, and it's a metaphorical train with jugglers and clowns and Renaissance people on board this train, which hadn't been invented yet, huh? So I looked at that, I said, oh my God, you know, this man is reading my mind, you know, this is...
Well, even that architecture must have reminded you about houses in your hometown.
Well, and here, see, this turned out this house was across the street from where I used to live, down Temple and Figueroa, down at L.A., and I lived in a tenement in and out of there 55 years ago, and I wrote a play about it called The Wonderful Ice Cream Suit, about all these characters, Martinez, Gomez, Vionasul. And it's playing here in town right now over at the Nosotros Theater at Wilton and Fountain. And it's had quite a career with as a musical with Jose Feliciano. But anyway, I discovered when I finally met Joe, this is a house across from where I used to live. And it was still there when I met him. They moved it over alongside the freeway going out to Pasadena. There's a Heritage Square area there, where if you pass by and can find the right turn off, you can visit all these old Victorian houses, which they should have left right where they were, near Bunker Hill. But anyway, I looked at the second painting of this carnival train from the Renaissance, and I went really crazy. I said, good God, this guy's reading my mind. This is a short story, a preparation for a novel. Who knew I was writing Dark Carnival? And I never finished that story. The book came out. The story's not in the book, huh? The Dark Carnival. So I wrote it later. After I met Joe, I did a screenplay for Gene Kelly called Dark Carnival. And I carried out all the ideas that I've been thinking about since high school, about this carnival coming to town with a carousel and making you older or younger, what have you. And because I'd fallen in love with, we knew Gene Kelly at that time, 45 years ago, and we were invited to his house on occasion, which was just beautiful because he made the greatest musical ever made, Singing in the Rain, which happens to be a science fiction musical. It's about the genesis of sound, huh? So you dream sound, you build sound, and you live sound. That's science fiction. And most people never put that label on it, but that's what it is. What happens to people's lives when sound comes into motion pictures? What happens to people's lives when television arrives? What happens to them with a computer? That's all science fiction. And before the fact, we're just dreaming, okay? So we knew Gene quite well, and he invited us to see a preview of Invitation to the Dance, which is his all-dance film. It's mixed combinations. Some of it works very well, some of it doesn't work too well, but that was a brave attempt to do something different for the screen. And I came out of that anyway, revved up and walking home with Maggie. I said, God, you know, I'd tear off my right arm to work for Gene Kelly. He's a great creative genius and he's a nice guy, huh? So she said, for God's sake, go find something in your files, write it up and give it to him. So I went through my files, I found the short story from Weird Tales, The Black Ferris, and I said, that's exactly the right thing. And I spent 2 months and I wrote a treatment outline and a semi-screenplay of 70 or 80 pages, Dark Carnival, and gave it to Gene Kelly. He says, yes, this is it. I love it. I want to direct this. Can I take it to London and Paris and see if I can get the money? I said, take it. It's yours. And so he went to London and Paris, came back a month later, says, I'm sorry, Ray, but I couldn't get any money. No one wants to do this. I said, you don't have to be sorry. I'm so honored that you even tried. I mean, God Almighty, I'm so flattered. So I sat down then and began to write something, Wicked This Way Comes. And the screenplay became the novel, became the screenplay. I'm the strangest writer I can think of in the history of writing, because I do all these things which start as poems, become stories, become novels, become screenplays, or become screenplays first, and then become stories, then become novels. I never know what in hell is going to happen next.
That's like one of Joe's trees that just germinate.
Yeah, that's right. Everywhere. And you just go with it. But I can't think of any other writer. There's no other writer that's done this peculiar thing.
The best analogy is with a composer who will take a motto.
Yeah.
And then it'll flower and grow and change.
That's true. People like Berlioz kept things around for years and inserted them in Symphony Fantastique or whatever.
Talk about a science fiction composer.
That's true. That guy. Yes, he is. Absolutely. Because he wrote his book, Evenings with the Orchestra, has a science fictional chapter about a symphonic city of the future.
Huh? Euphonia, or what is it called?
Yeah, I think that's right, Euphonia.
It's
up on the shelf here anyway, we can check.
And the wild musical instruments they play.
Yeah.
All very
so you're the only person I've ever talked to that knew about this. Huh?
Well, I love Berlioz.
Yeah, and
there was a visionary, I'll tell you.
Well, he was, of course, he influenced, when you think of Mussorgsky and all the people who came later, Tchaikovsky and name your other Russian composers later in that century, it had to be that Berlioz influenced them. Yeah. There are overtones in Mussorgsky, which are pure Berlioz. Huh? But anyway, I fell in love with Joe's work immediately. And
they put you in touch with him, I assume?
I said, how much is the second painting? First painting was $200 or $300. Second big painting was $400 or $500. Well, impossible, you know. So I said, you know, will you give me his address and phone number? So I called Joe up in Altadena.
Same house, I believe.
Same house, yeah. And I said, can I come up and visit you? Because I love your work. So he invited me up, and a friend of mine drove me up because I've never learned to drive. So I'm always driven somewhere by someone. And I got up there, and of course I saw all of his gorgeous stuff. And I said, look, let me be as honest with you as possible. This one of these paintings I want to buy, but I can't afford the gallery price. Now, they pay you 50% of the total, don't they? That's right. Okay, I said, I don't mind gypping the gallery, which it isn't really a gyp anyway, but if the painting doesn't sell and it comes back into your hands, I'll give you what you would have got anyway, huh? $300 or $200, depending. I can't afford $500 with a gallery. He said, fair enough. I said, let me know. I hope the thing sells for your benefit and the gallery's, but also I'm hoping it won't, because then I'll come and buy it from you. Well, 2 or 3 weeks later, he called me. He says, come get the painting. And I bought this one first, the Gothic house.
First impressions of Joe.
Well, let me finish what he did here. I found out later he pulled the painting out of the gallery to give it to me. Huh? Now, I mean, that's really something, isn't it? So our friendship began on a note of his wanting to please me with my not even knowing it. I found this out years later. So I made an agreement with him to buy both paintings over a period of time. This one for around 150. I think the asking price was 300, I can't remember. And the other one was 400, I think I paid 200, but over a long period of months.
Because is it one of the other
ones? I'll show it to you later, yeah. And anyway, I said to him, you know, one of the reasons I'm seeing you is I want to buy your paintings, but also I've got some books coming up, and I want you to do covers for the books. I designed most of the covers for most of my books.
That's what he told me.
Yeah.
He said that you had a very fine eye for concepts.
That's right. That's right.
And he was very generous about acknowledging that.
Well, I'd made rough sketches. You know, I'm not an artist. But if you know what the metaphor is, you know, put down the metaphor, as crude as it is, and show it to him and say, hey, you know, you take off and fly, I won't bother you. So I designed my first book, Dark Carnival. I had some Mexican masks. I went to the Art Center, Art Center College, and I said to the head of the college, show me all the photographs by your best photographic students. And he introduced me to the work of 12 different photographers. And I picked one, and I gave him all the material. I said, now, here are the masks I want to lay out for this book, Dark Carnival. But, you know, I release you, fly. So he brought me back three examples, and Derleth and I picked one of them, which is on the original cover. Well, it's not a selling cover because you put it down among other books and it disappears. I didn't know much about that sort of thing at the time. But in the meantime, Martian Chronicles came out, Illustrated Man, and then coming up next was Fahrenheit 451 and The Golden Apples of the Sun. So I said to Joe, now I need a cover. I got this okayed by Doubleday. I need a cover for Golden Apples of the Sun. Can you give me an example? Well, he brought me 20 of them. Yeah, he did 20 covers. And brought. I said, my God, what did he do?
Drugs.
Yeah. And
these were cover designs. Okay.
Yeah, jacket designs. And I have at least a half dozen or dozen of them still put away. And I picked one and sent it to Doubleday, and that's the one they used on the Golden Apples. And then Fahrenheit was coming up, and I said, well, now I introduced him to the Ballantine people. And I knew what I wanted there. I'd seen a sketch of his based on the mythology of Don Quixote. And Don Quixote as the put-upon dreamer, somewhat similar to the Gustave Doré things, but with Don Quixote with his hand over his eyes, in his armor. And I loved the image so much, I said, now, I'll tell you what we do. Why don't you dress this knight in newspapers? Huh?
That was your idea.
Yeah, the armor is all newsprint, you know, and have him standing on a bonfire of books, and the books are burning and he's burning. He's got his hands over his eyes. That became the metaphor for Fahrenheit 451, which we should still use more often. I still think it represents the book.
I think one of the very last paintings he did was a redo of that for, what edition was it?
Eastern Press.
Eastern Press, right.
Yeah. And so that's the way we worked with each new book that came out and the illustrations for Golden Apples of the Suns, I would give him suggestions. You know, in many cases, I wouldn't say anything. I said, read the story. The metaphors are there, and you give me something that seems appropriate.
Now, the question now becomes, as a result of seeing his drawings, did that further fuel your own ideas or concepts in your own writing?
Oh, I think so, but it's hard to guess at that sort of thing. Anyway, it was a perfect marriage, and I told him the best advice you can give to an illustrator, don't show any of the characters' faces. Huh? And people make the mistake in a lot of the limited editions of the great authors, Austen or Kipling or Dickens, or whatever. They show you the faces of the characters. And then the readers say, no, I'm sorry, that's not Scrooge, or that's not Marley, or that doesn't look like Jane Austen's heroine. It doesn't look like Kipling's The Man Who Would Be King. And I said, you know, turn the faces away. And then the reader can imagine what the face looks like. Because the body can be almost anything, you know, and still represent the character. So he always did that. If you could look through it, all the illustrations, it's rare that you see a face.
The murderer is one, I think, where we see the face, but that's behind the dwarf.
Yeah.
You're right.
Yeah. Yeah. There's something as grotesque as that you can play around with.
You know, I think it's a shame that some of the English editions, like the Something Wicked that I brought and The Day It Rained Forever, that we in America don't know those Mugnani illustrations, because those are awfully fine as well.
It's true. Yeah. Well, and I loved his illustration for the Eastern edition of Something Wicked This Way Comes, and I made him do a duplicate of it for me. I've got that up in my fax room. So I paid him. And we always had fights.
Oh, tell me.
For 40 years, you know, I want to buy things from her. Oh, you know, I'll give it. Joe, you know, come on, stop being the artist, you know. You've got to value your things as much as I do. And I told him I wanted to buy a duplicate of the Dust Witch and the Balloon, a duplicate of the Easton Press book. And I sent him a check for $4,000, and he sent back $2,000. You know, I said, "Don't do this." And I sent that back to him, and he sent it then to the Goodwill or some Catholic group. You know, and I just had finally to accept the fact that this is the way he was. But still, damn it to hell! I don't want to take advantage of artists. Too many people do that. It's a bad world out there, and people are very cheap, and gallery owners are, a lot of them, not nice people, as far as I can guess from what I've heard. You know, I don't have firsthand evidence of this, but I hear from other artists. And so there was a continual fight between us about my buying things. So I have 200 or 300 of his things, though, that he just gave me, you know, sketches, bits and pieces of concepts, lithographs, and what have you. And so I feel very fortunate. The griping thing about all this is that he never got the recognition that I thought he deserved. When I think of people like Jackson Pollock and Mr. Klein and the others, the really badly talented people, I mean, really lousy talents, no talent, in fact, those people, or some of the other pop artists.
Well, even people like N.C. Wyeth still are not taken as seriously in academic circles as they should be.
They're too popular. The great thing about Wyeth, I went to his exhibit, and I was in Chicago between trains, and I went over to the Art Institute 8 or 9 years ago, whenever it was, and there was a line around the block, you know, for Wyeth. And I managed to get in. I went to the door and I said, "Please, God, let the curator know who Ray Bradbury is." It's a few times. I don't pull rank most of the time, but I only had 2 hours between trains, and I went to the door and I said, "Who's the curator?" "Well, tell him that Ray Bradbury's here." Well, I got in, thank God. But and the Wyeth show was incredible, incredible. And of course, I loved his father before him too, and as a child. But the fact that nobody knows who Joe Mugnani was just rankles with me terribly. And anything I can do to the end of my life to change that, I will. Like talking to you, you know, maybe we can get more going for him, huh?
Well, I'm hereby inviting you to come to the tribute to him that we're mounting in St. Louis, October 4, 5, and 6 next year, which you already know about, the Archon out there,
right.
And you're coming, of course.
Yeah.
And it just seemed like a good time to talk about him as well as to talk about you, and indeed to talk about the both of you.
Yeah, sure, well.
People like me do have a tendency to put both names together. I think few authors have been better served by a so-called illustrator in this century.
No, he's my brother, he's my twin, and it's just incredibly fortunate that one. What if I hadn't gone by that window that night, huh? That's really scary. These things scare you when you think about them. His life would have been changed, and mine too, forever. I would never have found, I can't think of any other illustrator for certain kinds of things. I'm finishing my vampire stories now, which I started 45 years ago, The Homecoming and all these other family, vampire family stories, which I started 50 years ago. And one of the first illustrations for the very first story was by Charles Adams, you know, and he started his family vampire stories around the same time. So we were running on parallel tracks.
And you're talking about the Elliott family.
That's right, yeah. And so...
bring back Cece.
Yeah, we made plans. We made plans of doing a book together, Charles Adams and I. But we never did have a chance to do it. And, of course, he died 4 or 5 years ago without anything being accomplished. Now, my next choice for the book is Ronald Searle, huh? Uh-huh. Yeah, because his book on the Christmas Carol, have you seen that one?
No.
Oh, it's gorgeous. It came out about 15 years ago. Oh, the atmosphere.
Everett Chin's book.
Yeah, well, he's done some May books, these, but...
Before we leave the topic, what are you going to call the vampire collection?
From the Dust Returned, I think.
How far ahead?
I'm sorry?
How far ahead are you thinking for publication?
Well, I'm working on it now. I've been doing stories, new stories for it during the last 2 years, some of which have been published recently. And now I'm trying to put a frame on it, you know, adding, I'm building a house and filling the rooms, huh? Because Cece's in the attic room and the Timothy's over here and there's room for a spider and then it's got to be a gargoyle, a stone dog gargoyle that shows up at the door. It's taken 2,000 years to travel a few miles, you know, just a half an inch a year or whatever. And I, all the unusual things that I, when I was in Paris last July, I attended the wedding of a close, dear friend of ours. And there was a double wedding. There was a civil ceremony, which was beautiful. I thought it would just be horrible and dry and technical, but it was held in a beautiful room with gorgeous French murals, modern French murals, and by a civil servant in a wonderful tricolor sash, you know, and the whole thing done with great humor, and all of my friends were there, and Maggie and myself, and there were a lot of children running around, you know, and then we all went out in the garden and had champagne. And but there was this one little boy there, 3 years old, so beautiful and so full of joy, so full of life, running around like a fountain. You know, you think about the fountain of youth and all the Spanish conquistadors searching for the fountain of youth, Ponce de Leon. And here's this boy, you know, and you just want to grab him and take him home and say, stay there, you know, whatever it is, you don't grow, huh? Stay free forever. And I came home and wrote a story about him, and he's a member of the family, and he stays free forever. Huh? Ah. It's a variation on a story I did about the older boy who never grows.
Which you dramatized for your theater.
That's right, and he goes from family to family. But this boy, this kid is different. He's three, and he passes from hand to hand in the family. When there's been a death, huh? When there's been a sadness, then they call across the world, and they send the three-year-old for a week to make everyone happy again. Huh? So he's a toy that passes. So this is a new story that goes into the book. I'm just waiting for these things to regurgitate out of my subconscious. And when I'm done throwing up, the book will be finished.
Huh? Now, will this incorporate the stories you've already written about the Elliots? So it'll be a complete package.
That's right. There's seven or eight already. And but
publisher?
It's been
publisher yet?
No, because Knopf hasn't behaved recently. They've neglected my books. They let Halloween Tree go out of print just before Halloween. Yeah. Come on. I mean, really, what am I supposed to say to that?
More of Joe's work too.
That's right. Yeah. That's right. And I sent them a new book, a new fantasy, a children's book a year ago. And they never acknowledged receipt, and they sent it back without a note. Now, these are people I've been working with for 25 years. So, you know, the old saying, paranoids are not born, they're made. Well, I'm a little paranoid with Knopf, so the new book will go to someone else now, along with a lot of others.
I hope you won't mind if a few months down the line I get back in touch with you to see how it's going. I want to follow
up. Oh, sure. Yeah. Well, get in touch next summer. I ought to have it done by then.
Would you talk with me a little bit about Icarus Montgolfier Wright, the film that you guys did together?
Yeah, sure will.
I saw Joe's own print he brought down to show me. It's the only place I've ever seen it.
Yeah,
he was so tickled that somebody wanted to see it. I guess it's not been available for a while.
Well, it hasn't been available, period. It's there, but people don't know where to get hold of it. It was released at one time by Pyramid Pictures, I believe.
Yeah. Is it still? Was it Pentacle or Pentangle?
I don't know.
Something like that, but no longer.
Yeah. I don't know if there is a distributor. And
the we're going to show in St. Louis will be his own.
Yeah, I would like to go back this late in time and get hold of Herb Klinn, the producer. I think he's still alive. I saw him about 2 years ago. And he's a little bit older than myself. And cut about 3 minutes out of the film because it was I was much younger then. You know, I was 41 or 42 when I made that film. I still hadn't learned a lot about timing, and it doesn't need to be a 17-minute film. It could be a 14-minute film. It hasn't got that much to say. But now that we have video cassettes, it might be easier to go in and re-edit the thing and cut 3 minutes out and make a nice film then. Right now I get impatient. I look at it. There's some section where I say, okay, you made your point. Come on, let's get on here. And but it's...
Were you privy to Joe's drawings during the process that he was working on?
Well, again, he gave us 1,000 drawings, you know, without permission. Well, you know, you couldn't stop him. He was, you turn on the faucet, boy, and you can't find the handle to turn it off. Huh? So he... It was a great year. We spent almost a year making that film. We all worked free.
What year?
This is 1961, yeah. And audit format films. Joe didn't get any money that I know of, maybe $1,000 for a year's work. I didn't take anything because I just wanted to see it done. George Clayton Johnson, who helped on the screenplay, it was his idea to do it in the first place. Thank God he thought of it. And he introduced me to the format people, as I recall. But anyway, I worked on the script. I think George may have done a preliminary script. I can't remember now. It's too long ago. And I had meetings with the format people, and Joe came in, and he says, okay, stand out of the way. And he brought in dozens of sketches every few days. And some of the sketches are better than the final things on the screen because they're freer, you know. You can carry freedom too far, of course, then you turn into Jackson Pollock, you know, if you're not careful. Vanish up your own backside, as they say. So, but I have a lot of his, quite a few of those sketches. I wish I had more, which he gave me or I took one time or another. And the film came out, you know, and did a very limited release in a few theaters for a few days at the end of that year, 61, as I recall. Could be late, maybe 62. And then we got nominated by the Documentary Committee, the Short Subjects Committee for the Academy Awards. And there were 5 nominations. And we had a screening at the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences. And I went there with my wife and friends. And after they showed all 5 of the nominees, we came out in front, and Maggie and all my friends said, hey, it's a winner. It's going to get... I said, no, it's not going to win.
Some prophet you are.
Well, you know, I don't kid myself. I know which of my work. I know which would make screenplays, which wouldn't. I think I know anyway after all this time. And I said, look, it's a very nice film. I'm very proud of it. But I'll tell you who's going to win the award. They said, who? I said, it's a thing called The Hole. And it's got all the political correctness. We didn't use that term then, 1962. but it is on the nose with all our liberal friends who are going to vote for it. It's about a laborer, a black guy, a colored man. He's not black. He's a colored man because black hadn't been invented yet. He's digging a hole in the street. It's a hideout from the bomb. What do they call those things?
Bomb shelter?
I beg your pardon?
A bomb shelter?
Yeah, bomb shelter. Yeah, thank you. And it's a bomb shelter, as I recall. And there's going to be a nuclear war, you know. And I said, these are all the cliches. Yeah. People are building bomb shelters. They're going to vote for this. Mine, this is safe about the future. Mine is too far. See, space travel hadn't been invented yet, huh? Apollo missions were still 7-8 years ahead. Yeah. Who cared about space travel? Who knew anything about the Apollo missions? The astronauts hadn't been picked yet. Yeah. There's one or two, John Glenn, and maybe three others.
Well, at any rate, we're approaching Oscar time.
Yeah, oh yeah, okay. So I said, you know, the pit's going to win. And sure enough, Joe drove me to the Academy Awards. We had two tickets, which I bought. And we took Joe's daughter and Diane, and we took my daughter, Susan, and we dropped them at the Academy Awards down Santa Monica. We didn't go in. We sent them in. Sophie Loren sat right behind. Okay. And we went back at 10 o'clock to pick them up, and sure enough, the pit had won. And all the way home, Joe was saying, "God damn son of a bitch, bastard, you know."
He could have
erupted. He had a vile tongue, you know, and he could get away with it. The great thing about Joe was that, and I heard him lecturing in class at times. And, oh, he loved to shock me. I'm all over the place here. But I went down to the Art Center, the Otis Art Institute, 30 years or so ago. And when I'd only known him for a few years, and he invited me down to visit his class. Well, he didn't tell me what kind of class it was. I walk in and there's this naked girl lying there, you know, pubic hairs and all, you know. And I'd never seen anything like that, ever, you know. I'd never seen a naked lady in public. And I went into shock, you know, and Joe loved every minute of it, you know. He says, "Come on in, Ray, come on, give her a bite, come on, give her a bite." But it's interesting, you know, most men can't get away with this sort of thing. But women, it's astounding how many of them said to me, like Sam Jaffe's wife, Betty Jaffe, she was one of his students. And she said the same thing. Joe could say anything, and the women in his class never felt upset by it. Yeah. Huh? And I got it. Jeez, I'm word associating like crazy here.
Please.
But Joe and I occasionally would go down to one of the museums and go through to look at the Tintorettos or a Goya. They had a Goya down at the main museum, which was not a good one. Goya could make mistakes like everyone. His Euterpe, which we paid a hell of a lot for, it's worthless as far as I'm concerned, and I'm a big Goya fan, and so was Joe. Well, we went through, and in the middle of looking at all these Tintorettos, and the doyen came through, a docent, yeah, and she was leading a group of 20 people through, and pontificating here, pontificating there, you highfalutin talk, you know. I love it. In the middle of it all, Joe threw his head back and said, "Bullshit!" Well, all the pictures went bang, and they hung wrong on their hangers. Dust fell off the ceiling, you know, and the starch went up everyone's spine, you know, and they all marched out of the room like wooden soldiers. And I grabbed Joe and hugged him and kissed him, and I said, "Oh, Joe, I've been wanting to say that for years. The people that take art that seriously, you know." So that's one of my favorite anecdotes. And when I spoke at his memorial service, I was the first speaker that day. God help us, you know, terrible, terrible thing. And I ended my speech, I said, well, you know, I hate to be banal, but I know wherever Joe is, and I hope he's somewhere, he's crying bullshit, you know, and all the clouds are hanging wrong, and God's having a nervous breakdown.
You know, I have a theory where he is. He talked about when he was a kid looking at this label on a soap can, and it had an elephant on it. And there was another picture inside that with another elephant. It was one of these telescoping things. And he always was trying to get past the third elephant.
I've been on the stage since I was 12 years old. I was forced into trying out for a musical Christmas thing when I was in seventh grade. And I didn't want to try out for it, and my teacher made me, and I tried out and got the lead. Well, that was a big mistake because I was hooked. And I fell in love with Chandu the Magician and Tarzan and Buck Rogers on radio. In the meantime, I was acting on the stage, and in high school I wrote the student talent review. Without anyone asking me, I showed up for the tryout. I had the whole thing written. I got the job of writing and helped produce the student talent show. So theater has been a big part of my life. It's metaphorical theater. And I got to a certain age where I looked around at what was being written for the theater, and no one was writing science fiction plays. I said, well, what the hell? Why shouldn't I write them? And that's what I've done. I've done 30 plays now.
Have they all been collected together?
Yeah, there's a huge collection called On Stage, put out by, I can't think of the publisher in New York, and it's a Christophany of Ray Bradbury plays. The stupid thing, they put that on. I said, what in hell is that, you know? I said, say, it's On Stage, Christophany. Well, anyway, my love affair, and I've written poetry, you see, and it's all metaphorical. There's hardly a poem that doesn't represent a metaphor of some sort. And some of it's very good, some of it isn't, but I don't publish anything that I hope it's bad. But if they would just look then at my, at God sending me into the world genetically, metaphorically inclined. I couldn't help myself. You know? I didn't plan to do this, but now that it's all out there, it's quite natural I would do Moby Dick finally, because I was influenced by the Old Testament.
And thanks for your book finally on that.
Okay. And I was influenced by Shakespeare. And then I was influenced by cities, so I wound up in charge of the United States Pavilion at the New York World's Fair. I wrote the show for the top floor, the history of the United States. 400 years and 17 minutes flat with a full symphony orchestra. And then the Disney people came and hired me to create the interior of Spaceship Earth at Epcot. Same thing, metaphors. And then down at the Space Museum here, I created a thing, Windows on the Universe, but it's all astronomical metaphors.
It's a world thirsty for metaphors. Yeah. Maybe it's our only way of connecting with the really meaningful things around us, huh?
Yeah, you can't pick a thing up unless you can put a handle on it. And I was down at Houston meeting all the astronauts 30 years ago, and I got, life had sent me down. I tried to get them to fire me. And because they said, why do you want to be fired? I said, because I don't know what I'm looking at. I have 1,000 bombardments of detail in a few days. It's confusing. They said, well, we won't fire you. We believe in you. I said, how much time do I have? They said, 48 hours. And they forced me into thinking late at night that I came up with a metaphor. I was looking at the theater of history with actors, scripts, directors, stages, rehearsals, and if you don't do all this, you get out in space, you're dead. Huh? It's the quickest death ever invented. I mean, you could die at sea, but it's going to take you a little while. You get up there with a leak in your carriage, boy, you're in big trouble.
Kaleidoscope.
Yeah, that's right. So I guess that's the main thing I wanted to say. If you just look at all my work in that way, then you'll be well off. And make the relationship, cross the relationships between films and the Illustrated Man and the Martian Chronicles. Everything has been passionate, emotional, and unintended. I've lived the life described by Federico Fellini, who became our friend in Italy 16 years ago. And he said at one point, "Don't tell me what I'm doing. I don't want to know." And that's the way I've lived. I don't know what I'm going to do tomorrow morning. I didn't know what I was going to do today when I got up.
Don't you think it's important to leave us free, that we can create a little bit as we read along with you?
Exactly. If I'm not surprised, you're not going to be surprised. So I'm doing a one-man, one-actor play right now, taking monologues from a lot of my plays and some of my short stories, long dissertations, which is the fun of Shakespeare, you know. Or going to the ballet means seeing the same thing over and over again. Yeah, I've seen Swan Lake 50 times. I've seen ballet 400 times in my life. And hell of a lot of it over and over and over again. But one year you're seeing Rhea Boshinska, and another year you're seeing Danilova, and then you're seeing Baryshnikov later, whereas you saw Fokine originally, perhaps. And the fun comes in comparison, making comparisons, as you do with Shakespeare, between Olivier's Hamlet, Burton's Hamlet, and
now Branagh's. That'll be out soon.
Yeah. Well, he's a mixture, though. He's not... He's okay, but I played part of Othello the other night, and it's wrong. The lead, have you seen it?
Yeah, it's Laurie Fisher.
Well, the black guy is completely miscast. He's too mean. He's too arrogant. He's from the wrong side of town. I'm sorry, that's not Othello, huh? And it's got to be a guy who's majestic, who's military, who's macho, but he's not so arrogant that you hate him. You got to care for Othello, because he's going to make a big mistake with jealousy, right? And there's too much sex. Othello smooches with Desdemona much too much. You finally say, "Hey, wait a minute here, hold off. You know, let's have a lot of tension. You must break the tension." And nowadays, everyone thinks you got to have sex all the time. You got to kiss all the time. Say, wait a minute, they should be apart from each other a little, so you can feel the electricity jumping the gap, shouldn't you, huh?
Don't tell that to Demi Moore. Remember, we had Reverend Dimmesdale and Hester Prynne getting it on inside the grain storage bin. Did you see the Scarlet Letter?
No, I've heard about it. Well, we were talking about it tonight with someone else here, yeah.
But I can't let this go by without asking, are there some television scripts, movie projects up ahead adapted from your work? Anything?
Well, of course, I've done, in the last 10 years, I've done 65 scripts for my own series. And I had to wait 40 years to get the control, huh? Because every time I had a meeting with NBC or CBS, they would always... you know, they try not to lay hands on me, you know, and leave their fingerprints. But I had a meeting with NBC 20 years ago. They wanted to do a series. It was all set up, you know, to get going. They were going to bring in one of the writers from the James Bond series, a very good guy, a very good writer, because I needed help doing the scripts, I thought. And I went to a final meeting with the various vice presidents of NBC. They're all gathered in one room with me and my agent. And we're talking about the series and the plans. And finally, one of the vice presidents speaks up and he said, "Well, Mr. Bradbury, what we don't want from you is anything too highfalutin." And I said, "Highfalutin? Highfalutin? I starred in Weird Tales. I was in Astonishing Stories. I was in Super Science Stories. I was in Captain Future for highfalutin." Well, he realized he'd said the wrong thing, huh? And he pulled back and he pondered for a moment. He says, well, what we really want from you is something like Franz Kafka. I said, Franz Kafka? Franz Kafka? Now, that's highfalutin. And I went around the room and I said, bye, 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 bye. And I left. And that was the end of my meeting with NBC. Huh? So similar meetings occurred over the years, time and again, by these idiots.
Huh? Well, we need some kind of a highfalutin index, some kind of a benchmark that marks what is and is not highfalutin.
Yeah,
well, I thought we only said that in Kansas.
But anyway, finally, 10 years ago, a producer came along and his associate, and they spent a year taking me to lunch and dinner and smoothing my feathers and say, hey, it's going to be okay, Ray. We'll protect you. We're not going to ruin you. We're not going to question you. You get to write all the scripts, you know. And at the end of a year, I believed them, and it turned out to be right. I had the control. I was able to help cast. If something went wrong, I could say, it's wrong, let's do it over. Huh? And so it's a damn good series. And out of 65, I think we only have 3 clinkers. Well, that's awfully good average, isn't it?
Now, the Sci-Fi Channel's been running them. I assume that's been nationwide. I know
they haven't told me.
They've been replaying them, at least out in my area. what about any future film projects? Anything perking?
Well, I've just finished Fahrenheit 451 as a script for Mel Gibson. He's going to do it over next year. I'll believe it when the cameras start turning. And I've just finished a new script of The Wonderful Ice Cream Suit for Disney. And that should start shooting next summer, I guess. That project's been around for years, mainly because of Roy Disney. He's a good guy. And then I've done a script for Doug Trumbull for one of his. He's putting together one of those rides.
The show scan.
That's where they crack your spine and jump you up and down. And they're horrible. I hate them, you know. But he wanted me to give him something with a brain in it, you know, and a heart and a soul. And in other words, I was part Scarecrow, part Tin Woodman. And I'm working with Buzz Aldrin, the astronaut, and Robert McCall, the artist who did that fantastic mural in the Air and Space Museum in Washington, D.C. So it's a good team. So I've turned in the script. Supposedly they're producing this thing, which will go into museums and malls somewhere. We'll see. So,
what do you think of the people who at 75 are rolling over and going to sleep already?
I don't understand them. Well, I'm lucky, you see. It's genetics, too, because I've never been sick a day in my life. I've never been in a hospital. So God... My mother lived to be 79. She was never sick a day in her life. So I obviously have her genetics, plus whatever else you need to be a writer. And George Bernard Shaw is my hero. I would like to imitate him and live to be 96 and have God hit me with a baseball bat, you know, on my 97th birthday and just knock me off the plate, you know. And by surprise, don't tell me what's coming. Yeah.
It's funny. How many times have I thought exactly that same kind of thing?
Sure, of course.
That'd be by surprise.
Yeah.
Maybe a few seconds notice. I don't know.
No. I don't want to think about it.
I don't want to know.
Okay. You had indicated that maybe you would show us a couple of things around the house.
I sure will.
Do we have a moment or two for
sure.
that?
Sure. Come on up in the...
Sure.
I'll show you my fax room. I've got a couple of things there.
I'll just bring this along if it's all
sure.
right. Test. Okay. Oh, there's Illustrated Man. Goodness.
Yeah.
Everywhere you look.
Yeah. Oh. This is one of the family cats here.
Yes.
Your
Well, this is an Ali Baba's cave,
yeah,
isn't it?
This is the other painting that brought me together with Joe.
Yeah. And you're right. How strange that bridge would be cut off at both ends.
Yeah.
Any idea when he did that?
That was around 1950, the year before I met him, perhaps.
Mm-hmm.
And this is the last thing he did for me that I bought for him.
Now,
this is the painting that turned into the Halloween tree. I did this 40 years ago. And I showed it to Chuck Jones, and he said, well, hell, that's the Halloween tree. Let's do the film. So I wrote the screenplay, and when I finished it, MGM shut down their animation unit, and I wrote the book then while I was waiting to resell the screenplay. And then 3 years ago, Hanna-Barbera came along with Ted Turner and bought the novel, and I turned it back into a screenplay again. But it started with this painting.
I really like that.
Isn't it nice? Yeah, it's very pleasant. I'm a primitive. Yeah. Can't do humans worth a damn.
That's a better tree than I've ever been able to do, I'll tell you that. And then this Martian Chronicles I've not seen.
This is the play that I did 17 years ago for the Colony Theater.
And then there's from the Disney Something Wicked.
That's right. And these are all my family here.
This is an entire couch filled with animals.
We're going to clean up someday here.
I'm thinking of Toy Story. Do these come alive at night?
Of course they do. And here's a painting someone did of my sand ships on Mars.
Mm-hmm. Very nice indeed.
And there's the house where I began to write my stories when I was 12 years old in Arizona. Isn't that nice?
Wow.
Yeah. That's in
1932. You were 12 in Tucson House on South 4th Avenue.
Uh-huh.
And what's this?
Well, it's just a painting I saw somewhere, and it reminded me of my grandparents' house when I was a kid, so I bought it.
When's the last time you were back in Waukegan?
I was there 2 years ago.
Is the ravine still there?
Yep, and they renamed it for me. Yeah, with the ravine that scared the hell out of me when I was 5,
yeah.
The Phantom of the Opera.
Green Town, sure.
I went back, and they've called it the Ray Bradbury Park. Mm-hmm. They got Dandelion Trail leading down to the bridge, yeah, and a gravestone there with my name on it.
Oh, for heaven's sake.
But I took my aunt back with me, my Aunt Neva, and I took my first grade girlfriend with me. I called her in Michigan, and she came and joined me there, and we had a good cry.
Oh, that's nice. And is the ravine as mysterious as it might once have seemed?
Yes, yeah, you wouldn't go there at night.
Well, that's good to know.
No matter what.
Okay, I was counting on that.
My friend Charles Lawton here.
Sure.
We worked together for a year on various projects.
Now, what do you call this room?
Well, it's just it's supposedly a fax room. We got a fax here. We got a mimeo machine. We got an answering phone.
Now, I hadn't yet seen the paperback version of Bradbury Chronicles. Why didn't they keep the title that they were going to have originally? I'm trying to remember now what it was. Was it Dandelion Chronicles or something like that?
No one's
anyway. Seen. They changed the title.
See, here's the.
Crest.
Crestomathy. Can you believe that? Stupid.
Yeah. I'm not even sure I've heard that word before.
Yeah. And all the other plays, there's about 12 in here. There are 12 other plays published by Dramatic Publishing Company. And
of course, Don has copies of all of these things.
Yeah. Here's an example of the way they put out my plays, the Dramatic Publishing.
I'll be darned.
Yeah.
Now is that from a story, or is that an original play?
It's from the story.
Huh.
Yeah, it's sort of out of Dandelion Wine. These things go back and forth,
sure,
you know.
Sure. Have you seen Jumanji yet?
No, is it fun?
It's okay.
Is it?
Okay. I talked to Chris Van Allsburg not long ago, and some of the ideas in there are his, and he's well enough pleased. And look at this. Are you a G.K. Chesterton man?
Are you kidding?
Bless your heart. Oh, my God. Well, he is my main man.
His debates with Shaw are fantastic. I wrote two poems about the two of them, Shaw and Chesterton, Chesterton and Shaw, and published them in the Shaw Review a couple of years ago.
I just had a piece out in Armchair Detective about his detectives, Chesterton's detectives.
Sure, yeah.
I'll send you a copy.
Wonderful. Take this along.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely. Well, thank you. Frank, could I get you to... take a hold of that.
Sure.
I've got my arms filled.
This Windsor McKay spoof.
Yeah, I was working. I worked on the Little Nemo in Slumberland, the animated film for Tokyo Movie Shinza 12 years ago. And the guys, the animators who worked on it with me, two of them became the animators on the Lion King at Disney 2 years ago. And
hello.
And I was trying to think of the name of my, just a moment here. This is the producer of the Star Trek, Star Wars films. I've got a block on his name.
Oh, you mean Lucas?
No, this is the producer. Lucas was the director. And
I'm kind of shuddering to think what's coming next with those other three. I don't know.
Let's see now, just a moment. Oh, Gary Kurtz. You know his name?
Gary Kurtz.
Yeah, he produced, I think, three of those Star Wars, and this is Gary here. But he was always showing up for an hour, and we worked for months, you know. And then he'd come from London or Tokyo, and they made a joke of it. See, there is at the far end of the table. They can't see if it's really him, and then he. So. This is Andy Gaskill. He's one of the producers of the Lion King.
Well, how much of your contribution got into what actually got on the screen?
The Japanese didn't understand it. I solved the problem of integrating all of the Little Nemo Sunday episodes, and which was difficult. And I had came up with a double metaphor of Little Nemo, of Nemo and Omen, his other self. Nemo is the creator, and Omen is the dreamer, and you have to have both. You have to dream and do and dream. But otherwise, you're no good. If you just dream forever, you never do anything. If you do things without dreaming, it's meaningless. Huh? So the Japanese didn't understand this, and I put that in the script. It had the conflict between Omen and Nemo, the adventures going down inside his own skull. And
That's the Robert Schumann dichotomy of Florestan and Eusebius, the doer and the dreamer. Yeah. So many artists, I think, consciously articulate
that kind of thing. But they threw it out and they made a film for three-year-olds.
Yeah, it was awful. And I revere Winsor McKay. I have so many of those things in collections, and the film was just dreadful.
Frank, you know, wrote the book on the making of The Nightmare Before Christmas. I never can remember that title. The making of, so he was pretty privy to all that was going on that film.
Yeah.
The Tim Burton film.
Yeah, I have mixed feelings about it. I'm not comfortable with, I'm just not comfortable with doing that to Christmas.
Interesting, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, that's Tim Burton.
Right.
Well, he's a weirdo, all right, and he had a very interesting beginning at Disney with his little short subjects.
Frank and Weenie,
yeah.
Which I've never seen yet.
Oh.
Yeah, I saw it before he gets his career started.
Yeah, and Vincent, his first stop-motion animation.
That's right. And they showed it to me out there. I said, well, this guy's going to go a long way, and by God, he sure has.
Well, he's still making movies and loses money on every one, but he still gets another one somehow. So.
Has he lost money on all of them?
I think Beetlejuice probably did okay. But
yeah. Well, didn't he do one of the Batman things?
Yeah,
I think. Well, that first
one. Oh, that did very well.
That's true.
Ed Wood flopped mightily, although I like it very much.
Yeah.
I thought it.
Well, he's certainly interesting, and there's beautiful stuff in The Nightmare Before Christmas or whatever. And,
gee, how many people do I know who like Chester did at Bearlands? This is great. All this time, and I wasn't aware of any of that. Well, I want to make sure we're not outstaying our time. If I could get you to sign my drawing, it would be an honor.
Hey, Puss. That was a nice
laugh. 22
cats. Oh, it's gorgeous. It's a great day, you know. You know, I better sign this before.
Brought a pen that has a nice, bold blue line.
All right.
And if you could put L.A., it's the 15th of December. Make a nice, big, bold signature, though.
All right.
This makes the third one of you I've done over the years. It was back in 1966 when I did a pencil drawing of you and sent it to you.
My God.
And you mailed it back with a wonderful inscription. And that really kind of started me in my habit of drawing people that I interview.
There we go.
In fact, I have a letter from you when you turned 50. And I was in the Army at the time, really miserable about the whole thing. And now that next fall at St. Louis, that weekend, I will turn 50.
Good Lord.
So you're going to have to be there, Ray.
Oh, yeah. Talk to God about it now, will you, please?
Now, this is for a friend of mine. Well, first, this is yours. For her,
sure.
If you would.
Something here?